This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Do you say and do things when drinking that you regret the next day? Is alcohol a problem for you or someone you really care about? Over the next hour, we'll find out how people just like you and me found sobriety in AA through sharing their experience, strength and hope. Welcome to AA Live, brought to you by Alcoholics Anonymous.
Stefano, welcome everybody to the AA Live Radio Show. Happy New Year 2025. I can't believe we're here already. Look, I hope Christmas and New Year's was kind out there to you. You know, just kind people, kind things happening to you. That's all I wished for, really. I enjoyed time with my son. We put our feet in the sand and our feet in the sea, spent time with some good friends. We spent time with people in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Good food. Oh, my gosh, so much good food and lots of laughs. And some true relaxation in its perfect form. Yeah, that learning to do nothing in recovery, as in sit still in myself, was absolute joy. So here we are, the beginning of the year. So at the beginning of the year, we start with one step. As you know, the 12-step program correlates with the months. So this month, we have got step one, that we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. My gosh, that was a huge one for me. It took me a long time to figure out that I was powerless over alcohol. Luckily, I heard that on my first time coming into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So one thing I'd love to say out there today is if you have picked up or you think you need to come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, head on in. We'd love to see you. Remember, the door always swings both ways. So jump on aa.org.nz. Now, for me, yeah, people come, people go. But if you want to be in there and you're thinking, I need to check this out, I've got to tell you, folks, they are incredibly welcoming people. Maybe you'll be surprised at the similarities. That's what happens for me. Well, so I had the privilege of catching up with the parent of an alcoholic recently, spent a bit of time with this person, had a great chat, which I was lucky enough to be able to record. So I started off by asking him how life was being the parent of an alcoholic.
Well, I've just been through a pretty tumultuous time just recently. So, you know, this is the way it goes, isn't it? It seems to be fine for ages, well, sometimes not even ages, sometimes just days or weeks. And then it all flares up and away we go again. It feels a little bit like the old hamster, just got thrown on the hamster wheel again. And you know that here we go, we're in for another round. You know what, I know what this one's going to involve. Yeah.
And is this with your child? Adult, I'm assuming?
Yeah, son, yeah.
Yeah, and what sort of age group?
Just about to turn 30.
And how long has he been drinking?
Hard to say. Pretty sure he was sort of doing it on the sly, you know, when he was quite young. Had some friends that lived down the road and, you know, we thought were quite upstanding sort of humans in our society and turned out they weren't really, you know, they were a bit fake. The husband was a real estate agent, drove the big Merc and everything, seemed to impress my wife at the time, and I always thought, well, it's just a car at the end of the day. And you know, they lived in a big flash house and my son would quite often go down there and stay, you know, started off for the night, and then next thing, he was only 13 at the time, and then he's staying for the weekend, and then he's staying you know, every day. And I said to my wife, I said, well, where is he? I haven't seen him for days. And she said, oh, no, he's fine down there. They're really nice people. And, you know, rah, 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 rah. Well, it wasn't until years later that I actually found out that, you know, well, the father, he was off in his own little world, and the mother was a raving alcoholic, and she pretty much just sat around pissed all day and let the kids do whatever they wanted. And my son and his mate were downstairs in their own little zone, and they could smoke dope and do whatever they wanted to do, which was pretty horrific for us to find out, you know, all those years later. And it was only when he got old enough that he didn't really care, and he just said, oh, no, that's not what's what was happening up the road at all. What was really happening was this, you know. And that, I suppose, it goes to show how you can be sucked in by, you know, the facade of the house and the flash car and, you know, the flash job, whatever, you know. Yeah, so.
One of my experiences definitely that this, the pull of alcohol is definitely not got any limits. It doesn't, it reaches from the gutter to the royalty, if that's what you want to call it. Sure. But yeah, it's not picky on who it drags into its black hole, that's for sure. And so he started young, and I am assuming, like most of us who start drinking young, it's fun, we're chasing the high. When did it start becoming an issue for him?
Oh, look, straight away, really, because, you know, he'd been pretty decent sort of pupil at school, you know. Certainly never a real scholar, but, yeah, the teachers loved him. He was always teaching this, especially the female teachers. They just adored him, you know, and he was a good-looking kid. And sports-wise, you know, his first 15 and all that sort of stuff, and star goal kicker, and, you know, idolised Dan Carter and stuff. Oh, thought he was going to be in the All Blacks one day. And you know, him and I spent, oh, my God, hours down at the park, you know, kicking that damn rugby ball over the post, just a million kicks, you know. And he, look, if you went to the local athletics club in that city we lived in, his name was engraved on every single cup of every year, you know. He was a star, yeah. Mm. And then yeah, it just stopped, you know. Suddenly the you know, the what do you call it, the drive to do those sort of things just went west. And there was just no one home, and it's like, nah, just can't be bothered, you know. And, yeah, like I say, I mean, the drugs and the weed, yeah, sort of came together. I mean, a lot of people, there's a big thing about weed at the moment. I don't know, there's a lot of, seems to be a lot of people out there who think it, that it's fine and it should be legalised and everything. And honestly, from what I've seen, I disagree, you know. Yeah, so, yeah, I remember a psychologist at the time, you know, we had a family group conference because things started going a bit wrong. And she said, well, to us on the quiet, you know, we need to be a bit careful because basically the maturity gets frozen at this early age if they start smoking dope so young. And now I look back, now he's nearly 30. Honestly, he's still acting like a 13, 14-year-old. Often, you know, and those words just won't leave my head. They're just stuck in my damn head. And, you know, by 30, you know, you think about your own childhood and where were you at 30? Well, by 30, man, I don't know, it's not all about me, but I mean, I was well on the way to being just a decent citizen, you know, decent job. And yeah.
Yeah, it's debilitating, isn't it? And I know for a fact that in the rooms of AA, a lot of us have that discovery that when we picked up our first drink, that's pretty much when our brains stopped developing. And a lot of the actions that we took between drinking and finding sobriety were the decisions of, you know, young people, because our brains did freeze. So I completely understand what you're thinking with that. It's it's frightening, isn't it, as a parent?
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah. And so Has he been in trouble with the law?
Yeah, pretty much. As soon as this nonsense started, you know, yeah, he started getting in trouble. Nothing serious. I mean, he was never, you know, what you're naturally bad. You know, some of them are just bad little buggers. You know, they were just, I don't know, they have a bad streak. But he didn't. You know, he was sort of kid that just naturally would hold a door open for a woman, you know. So, yeah, to see him having trouble with the law was pretty tough. You know, my father was a policeman back in Ireland and, yeah. We were taught to, you never lie and you certainly never steal. And, yeah, I'm struggling with that one. I'm struggling today with that one, you know, because I just can't seem to get it through his head. Yeah.
That family pride?
Yeah. Well, that was a big thing for us. You'd never trash the family name, you know. Yeah, he doesn't seem to care.
Has he been to rehabilitation?
No, not a proper rehab.
Is that something? So, as an alcoholic, does he realise he's an alcoholic? Is he accepting of that as yet?
Yeah, I think it's fairly recently that he came out with a statement. Yeah, honestly, it's probably only 6 months ago. He said to me, I saw a video of myself down at the wharf fishing and I was pissed. And I said, right. And he said, I couldn't believe what I was looking at. He said, I'm the worst person I've ever seen. And I went, really? I said, because you know what? You're the worst person I've ever seen too. And you know what the really bad part of that is? You're my son. I said, you know, that is a pretty serious thing we got going on here, you know. And, yeah, it's been a battle. Like, I wish in some ways that I had made a log of everything that's happened now, all these years on, because, you know, it would be a fantastic reading because the system just seems to be buggered. Whoopsie, sorry. I've got to say.
You're okay.
I should have made the disclaimer at the beginning. I'm Irish, so it's really hard for me to keep those four-letter ones in. But anyway, we'll give it a go.
I appreciate you giving it a try.
no doubt you've got a beep button there somewhere. Good. Keep your finger close by, especially once I get onto the courts and the police. No, but look, there's been some good people along the way that have genuinely tried to help him and had a fair bit of trouble getting a read on him, actually. You know, at the beginning I was going to end up in court, you know, like I say, most of it was pretty minor stuff, but bad enough to end up in court. And I'd always go there. I'd be the only one usually. And
when you say only one, do you mean only parent that's supporting their child or?
Well, only
person that was there for him.
Yeah, for him, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And yeah, look, I got him off plenty of times. Not saying that's right. But, you know, I was the parent there putting my hand up saying, look, you know, I'm pretty sure I can get a handle on this thing. But at the end of the day, you know, I couldn't. That's one, I'm a builder, I'm a mechanic, I can do anything, you know. But I've always said to people, this is the one thing in the world I just can't seem to fix. Which is real tough. Yeah, real tough because, yeah, it's tough for somebody that can fix everything, you know. So anyway, back to it. The court system, I mean, I suppose if we just fast forward, I mean, he's been in our jail. He's been in jail 3 times. He's just gone back now for his 3rd time. You know, which, I don't know. I mean, I come from a massive family, massive Irish family, and no one's been to jail. You know, we're not a criminal family. It's, Yeah, it's a hard one. They just don't seem to get it. Nobody's addressing the problem. They're just incarcerating him, you know, and they may talk to him and work out he's an alky, but they don't actually do anything about it. He doesn't really get any treatment or anything.
That must be so frustrating as a parent.
Well, it is, because you see him dry out there. His head comes right. He rings me from jail. Some of the best conversations we've had in recent years have been when he's been inside, because he's straight in there, you know. And he comes out and he promises me, in his words, he said, "I'm just going to stick to you." He said, "I'm going to be right by your side. We're going to build and we're going to go and do up all the old vintage cars we've got and stuff." And he said, "I just won't go anywhere. I'll just stay with you." And he does that. And then, you know, within a short time, the demons come to visit. And I think recent times he tends to not come back home because of the shame, I think. You know, the failure. He wants so desperately to please me, and the demon won't let him, you know. Yeah. So he tends to disappear for days or a week and be absolutely blind that whole time. Mm. You know, I know for a fact that he gets up and has drink for breakfast, you know, he'll start the minute he wakes up. But in the earlier times, he was more, if he bought a box, which sort of saw from his mother's side of the family was very much like that. They would literally sit there and drink till the whole lot was gone. So they only ever bought enough to do the job, you know, that for that reason. So, I can remember sitting in sheds with them thinking, well, this is an education. And they would literally drink two crates of beer and then write, "Anybody here got any more at home?" And they would literally drive an hour back to their place to get it and bring it back. And then when they had exhausted everybody's stocks at home, and whether that was one day or 2 days, they would then go home, you know. And I was just went, wow, that's out of it, you know. And he was very much like that. He would literally just drink till it was all gone. And there was no such thing as, I said to him one night, I said, you know, and that was when we first started sort of drinking together, you know, like normally he would always drink away from me. So I said, "Well, yeah, let's have a beer together, you know, and then I sort of want to see what's going on here, you know." And then I sort of went, "Well, hold on a minute, you've got, actually I can count three beers on the go at the moment. You've got one open over there, one open over there, and one in your hand." I said, "And you look like you're set to, you know, drink the box." And I'm going, "Ever thought of maybe saving a few for tomorrow?" And he's, "Why?"
Yeah, right.
"Why would I want to do that?" Like, it was, yeah, bizarre. Yeah.
It was binge drinking, and that's that. For you in your life, how has this affected your life and your movements? And
Well, his mother and I ended up splitting up when he was probably about, you know, he was a good couple of years into it. Got pretty stressful. You know, you wouldn't dream of turning around and blaming him for our failure, but certainly put a load of pressure on us, because I'm going, let's get down the road and get him home. You know, he shouldn't be there. Something's going on. I can feel it in my waters, you know. And she's going, "Are you paranoid, mate?" You know, and
it'd be difficult when you've both grown up in different households. From what you were saying before, I was hearing for you, it was quite normal to put one down. For her, on her bringing up, it was quite normal to finish them all.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So, like I say, eventually, you know, we parted company, and then, you know, it made it easier for the authorities and stuff. "Well, look, he's from a broken family. There it is, you know. It's always there. It's never too far away." It's just such an easy thing to blame. And really, it was such a cop-out, because, you know, prior to him turning 16, say, you know, we had done a million miles around the country to every athletics event, and, I spent so much time flying radio control aircraft together with him and just doing loads, you know.
Keeping him busy.
Yeah, just doing loads. His little sister came along when he was 10 years old, which I honestly believe is the heart of his problem, and really it's come out of him so many times one way or another to different people, and they've made a comment to me and I've gone, yeah, it's there, right? And really what happened was his little sister came along, and for some reason, and I'm not a psychologist, so I can't tell you why, but his mother seemed to have some belief that you can't love two, you can only love one. So she basically turned him off and turned herself on to the new one. And it was just unbelievable because, you know, she was sort of, her style of parenting was a bit sort of touch neglectful, closely followed by over-parenting or spoiling them to sort of compensate. So I don't know, there's a name for that style of parenting. I can't think what it is now. But she had been pretty over the top with him and then just dropped him like a...
Yeah, that feeling of abandonment would have landed on his doorstep pretty quick.
Oh, look, and many people have rung me and asked me, there's something going on with this guy, you know, and I reckon it's something like this, and I've gone, well, you know, they really want to throw the mother under the bus because, I mean, nothing's going to be gained by throwing her under the bus, but it's probably where it started, you know. And boys and their mums, you know, I know what I'm like was like with my mum, you know. It's hard to imagine her doing that to me. And she never did, you know. So, yeah. So, like I say, back to it. I see the cycle now going round and round. And here we are, another round of prison.
And so has your life been put on hold, do you feel?
Yeah, look, I've had... Sorry, I skipped your question before.
No, you're good.
In context, it was about the relationship, my relationships, because, it was easier. You know, I had relationships after her and they were really strained, you know. They were really strained because they either didn't want their kids to be, if they had kids, to be around this guy that's acting out, which is fair enough. I'm in and out of the courts with him and it's just all a bad look, you know.
High stress
and, you know, maybe them not understanding that you got to stand by your kids no matter what.
I hear that value in you sharing with us now that family, your children, it's incredibly important to you.
Definitely, which does make it harder, you know. It would have been probably so much easier for me to just turn off him and go, you're on your own. Yeah, silly little shh. Beep. You know, so, but that's, you know, that's a cop-out. You know, we've got to take responsibility, but...
I think a lot of parents have that same struggle, Gordon. I know from my own parents, my mother has completely turned off contact with my brother, who's still active and in his 50s. Everybody has their limit and their boundaries that they have to put in place. I understand that. It's quite commendable what you're doing to date. Very commendable. Doesn't feel like it though, does it, looking at you there?
Well, hey, look, like I say, it's done in a few relationships for me because, yeah, it just got in the way. And then other ones, look, you know, I went out with a couple of people that were prolific drunks and my tolerance level was just super low to that. You know, I just thought, oh no, I can't handle a second one. You know, that's, and it's so much easier to see the patterns when you've had one in your family for so long, you know.
In AA, we would say that that came along to teach you something and it wasn't necessary for it to stay. Those experiences. So,
definitely.
Yeah, they're not regrets. Although we do say we don't live in our regrets, but we don't forget them either.
No, but
don't forget the past.
It does make you realise that, you know, some good people have gone by the wayside because they couldn't get the demon under control either, you know.
Well, I do find society, it's everywhere. It really is. I just wanted to step back a little bit. You were talking about a lack of support through community organisations. Have you had quite a battle with the court system, or is it authorities? How's that? Has it been difficult to ask for help or obtain help for him?
Yeah, well, probably easiest is probably to talk about things that have happened in the last year because they're quite fresh in my mind. You know, a lot of it's become a blur. A lot of it I've tried to block, to be honest, because it just can get overwhelming. But in the last year, he had a session there where he got on it, on the booze, you know, and probably smoking a bit of weed as well, I'm guessing. Don't know for a fact, but, you know, look, for a couple of months, he was just hammering it, you know, seemed to be drunk all the time. And I'd built a sleep out sort of thing at home for him because, look, I figured that, God, even if he is going to be in reckless like that, he's at least going to be safer if I can keep an eye on him. And maybe some miracle might happen, I can get it under control, you know. So, but anyway, long story short, he took something at ended up having a pretty psychotic episode at home, which was pretty blooming scary. And I had to ring the police, and they came and, you know, he was running around the section with huge knives and things, and you know, I was quite fearful that they were going to turn up and just shoot him, you know. Because really they can't risk themselves, you know. So, you know, I risked my own neck by, you know, sneaking out the back door and sneaking around behind him and basically stealing not big machetes and things from underneath his nose while I'm locked in my own house, you know. And, yeah, it was all pretty ugly. Yeah. And anyway, the police took him away and the CAT team wouldn't come.
When you say CAT team?
The you know, mental health intervention team. They wouldn't come but not for some reason. I'm not sure. Probably, who knows?
Understaffed, who knows?
Yeah, all those normal things that we know, we've learned to accept now. And so the police...
Have we learned to accept or we're just having to accept?
Yeah, absolutely. So the police didn't know what to do with him. They sure as hell didn't want him in their cells. So they basically got him to go with them voluntarily, and they took him to the psych ward. And he was in the psych ward there where they, for a month or more, and they sectioned him under the Mental Health Act, and a whole lot of things went wrong there, you know. I mean, I could write a book just on that alone.
Would you like to share that for our listeners? Or
yeah, it's long. It's long, right, and pretty awful. But, you know, I found the whole thing to be really unprofessional. A lot of the drugs they stuffed in him just seemed to be purely experimental. They were letting him ring me every night completely off his face. He seemed to be getting worse each day, and he couldn't control his tongue. You could tell he was choking on his tongue. He went from having this bit of a to his voice to literally choking on his tongue after 3 days. On the fourth day, he was choking so bad, I said to him, take the phone to one of the nurses. And I'm going, what's going on? He's choking. I can hear him in the background choking. She's going, oh, no, well, we've changed his meds. And I'm going, and it wasn't until I pinned her down and said, look, I'm going to bring you back in the morning. I want a list of every single medication you've given him and the dosage, the whole bit. I said, because you're just not giving me the right answers, you know. And it wasn't until I started asking questions like that and recording things that they started getting a little bit, okay, we better be a bit more attentive with this one. And they seemed to get the meds under control and stuff, and then, you know, time went by, things were going okay, we had a family group conference, and they said pretty much, look, the long and the short of it. And again, you know, by that stage I was well onto them, so I realised that I needed to get all my facts straight. So the beginning of the meeting, I made everyone tell me who they were, their role, blah, 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 and then we proceeded, and I basically controlled the whole interview and didn't let them fob anything off, you know, and they were pretty much just going to unlock the door and let them walk out of the psych unit, you know, in a T-shirt in the middle of winter, you know, and in a different city to the one that we live in. And I'm going,
were they looking at his alcohol use? Did they have something in the...
No, well, this was the problem. I asked them the question straight, point blank. You know, the doctor is there right in front of me talking to me, and I said, so what's your diagnosis? You know, and he rattles off this drug-induced psychosis and righty, righty, rah. And I said, anything else? And he goes, no. And I said, are you sure? And he goes, yeah. And I said, what, so no problem with the alcohol? And he goes, oh, yeah, well, he drinks too much. And I said, well, there's the biggest understatement I've ever heard.
Right.
I said, oh, I think you might want to have another wee look at that one. I said, do not look, read my lips, mate, do not open the door. And then I gave him a right dressing down. I said, look, you know, we've had all these different places talk about doing this, that, and everything else with them, but no one actually does anything. I said, I hate to use the farming analogy, I said, but have you ever tried to drench a sheep while it's running around the paddock? It's damn near impossible. I said, you've got the sheep in the pen, which is where you drench it. I said, you got them in the pen. I said, why don't you do something about the massive alcohol problem he's got now that, let's face it, he's had for about 15 years now. And nobody's looking at it, not the police, not the judges, not the, you know, the facilities inside the prison service. I said, you know, what does it take? I said, think, if nothing else, I said, think about the money it's costing the taxpayer, you know, for the police running around this clown, chasing these clowns all over town. And I said, and we've got mental health, and then we've got all the mental health people running all around town. I said, you know, and I'm not discriminating against them. I said, but at some point we have to wake up and say, what the hell are we doing with these people, you know?
And so did they organise something?
They assured me that they were going to. They sat there and they nodded and they said, yep, okay, you're right. And, you know, the doctor, well, I spoke to my son after that. He said after the meeting, the doctor stormed off and wouldn't talk to anyone. And I thought, okay. That's odd. Obviously didn't like the real opinion. And then it all went quiet. I didn't hear from him for a couple of days. Thought, that's a little odd. Then I happened to be driving through Palmerston North. And bugger me. Boop, beep. There he was. Sitting in the doorway of a shop with a brown paper bag in his hand, and I'm going, oh my God, that looks like...
Oh, how awful for you.
That looks like my son. I just about drove into the car in front of me. I couldn't believe my eyes. They literally unlocked the door and let him go. And...
Didn't call you?
Didn't, know. I rang them. I rang everybody. I rang the police. I rang everybody I could think of. Nobody rang me back. They refused to talk to me, and they still haven't rung me to this day. I rang the psychiatrist, the main psychiatrist at the social worker at the hospital, and nothing. Just no.
And so what happened from there? Did he come home, or did you go and retrieve him, so to speak?
Well, I went to retrieve him. I parked the car around the corner, and I walked back to where he was. Because I just got a really bad Celtic feeling. And I walked back and I just observed from a distance. And what I saw just disturbed me a bit. There were some big guys seemed to be standing over him. There was a lot of really strange behaviour going on. It sort of looked like potentially some drug deals going down. You know, it just didn't look right. And I thought, wow, this something's not good here. So I thought, well, if I'm not feeling right, I should just go home. And I know where he is. And it looked like he had made a cardboard house. You know, he was living in a doorway. And I thought, well, I'll come back tomorrow. I'll just have a breather and get a plan together, maybe talk to the police. So I went home, rang the police again. Look, I had a direct number to a local cop, and he said, ring any time. The guy still has never rung me back. So I don't know what's happened there. But anyway, I went back the next day, and, you know, the same sort of behaviour was going on. He saw me sitting in the car. He sort of ignored me. He didn't want to bring attention to me like he...
Or is he protecting you, perhaps?
Yeah, it seemed like that, yeah. And then eventually he came up and sort of said, I can't talk to you right now, really angry sort of thing, and then left, walked off, and then I just went home, left it, and thought, well, that was pretty out of it. He didn't look in great shape. In fact, he looked really bad. And, you know, a few sleepless nights. And then eventually, he turned up at home. I mean, that's one credit I will give him. He's a blooming survivor. You know, you can drop him in a ditch and he'll crawl out. And
he's got a beacon to
yeah,
you.
Yeah, he somehow can survive things that a lot of people wouldn't. But anyway, he eventually came home and he said, I'm a mess and da-da-da-da-da, I've got to get cleaned up, and, you know, and away we went. He stepped off the hamster wheel and we worked together and things, you know, got him back in good health and things started going pretty good again. And then that went on for, I don't know, maybe a month.
Yeah. What does it take to get him back into good health?
A lot, yeah, man. Really run down, you know, just when they've been living rough, you know, they have worms, they're just in such bad shape. Skinny as a rake and weak. You know, he says, I'll come to work with you tomorrow on the first day. I said, yeah, don't think so. I said, you wouldn't last an hour. You know, I'm a builder. He just wouldn't. And it's dangerous. You know, so had to get him. So I took some time off work and we just ate and played and, you know, did healthy stuff. And he piles the weight back on pretty quick. But, it's pretty scary. Yeah, can't.
Has he been to Alcoholics Anonymous?
Yeah, he did join up, yeah, just this time, just before he's vanished again. He did join up and he stuck at it for a little while, you know, a couple of weeks, and was going to meetings. I was taking him to meetings. I was happy to go to the next town to the meetings and sit there and wait for him and pick him up and make sure he didn't
disappear.
Come home via the pub, you know. So it was going right, you know, and he had a sponsor and I thought it was going good. He seemed to be quite upbeat with it. And then one morning I got up and I thought, uh-oh, where is he? And then he came walking through about 10 o'clock with his head facing the ground. And I just knew that something had gone wrong, you know.
He'd picked something up.
Yeah, brain explosion in the middle of the night, and off he went. And then that was it, you know. He's very much the in for a penny, in for a pound. So he just went and got something out of his room, probably some money, and disappeared again. And I came out and I went, hello, like, what about your sponsor? I said, there's 100 things you could have done better than this. I said, and you still can, you know. And he just left and disappeared for a few days. And then the next phone call I got was from jail saying, oh, they're holding me. I haven't been charged yet, but every day they come up with another charge. He says, oh, there's about 17 at the moment. I went, what? 17? I said, well, you've hardly moved an inch from my side, so where have they found 17 charges? He said, oh, a lot of them are historical, you know. He was going into all the local stores, supermarkets and things, and stealing booze. Always the same thing, stealing booze, stealing booze, stealing booze. You know, I mean, how many times, you know, I've sat in courts where the judge read out the list of stuff that he's stolen from shops, and it's like a bottle of wine, $15, a bottle of wine, $32, a bottle of wine. And honestly, the only good thing about it was that you seemed to be getting a better taste. But, you know, I thought to myself, how many of these things are you going to read out before you start to see a pattern? You know, it was just, and I'm just looking at the guy and he's going, what do you think, Dad? And I'm going, one word, booze. No booze, no crime. That's what I said to the judge. No booze, no crime. Always been the same. Look back through his records, you know. Yeah, you called it breaking and entering, but actually,
you're calling it addiction.
It was addiction. It's always addiction. Mm-hmm. It's always addiction.
It's a harrowing story.
So now they're saying, he said, oh, they trumped up charges. He said, I said, well, where were you when they picked you up? He said, oh, I was asleep in the grass across the road from a supermarket. I said, righto. Yeah, I mean, I suppose you got to laugh, don't you?
But, well, you have to. Otherwise, I think you'd cry.
Yeah.
He was possibly surrounded by bottles that he didn't remember.
Well, he had one in his hand.
Right.
And then, obviously, you know, they want him, I think their idea of helping him is send him inside to dry out for a while, you know, but really it's just put the old sticking plaster on until it falls off. And the wound underneath isn't necessarily healed. In fact, it could be twice as infected as it was, you know. So now they're saying, he said, oh, they're saying they found pee in my bag and all this sort of stuff. He said, I don't take pee, you know. So, I mean, he's pretty transparent, which is quite ugly most of the time. So, honestly, I think if he did take pee, he probably would have just told me.
Or interestingly, my brain instantly goes to the fact that quite a lot of us black out, and we actually, there's whole sections that we don't remember what we've done or what we've taken. So that's also from some of your descriptions of talking about him, maybe something he doesn't even recall yet.
Maybe.
It's frightening. And for yourself, have you been out to get support from any community groups? Have you joined Al-Anon? Have you, you know, that sort of thing? Have you heard of that? Have you?
No, not really. I feel, hey, look, I'm a people watcher for a hobby, you know. I love it. I love psychology of people. That's probably what I should have done for a job. Yes, I feel like I've got a pretty good handle on what's actually going on. So I don't feel, and I feel like, you know, there's been, look, in the past, I've done some crazy things, and sports-wise, you know, had a lot of crashes and things, given myself a bunch of concussions, which is not great. And, you know, when I've needed help, I've certainly gone and got help. So I haven't really felt like I've needed help with this. I know what it is. I think that probably just adds to my frustration that, you know, the everyone, and I'm not blaming the police for his actions, but, you know, the cycle that's going round and round just isn't working, you know. It's the definition of insanity, isn't it? Doing the same thing over and over, expecting to get a different result. And, you know, then multiply that by so many people out in the community doing it now, you know, we're on a bad, dark road. You know, we've got to do something different. And it's not rocket science.
If there were services that could change or help you and your son through this journey, what do you think would have been good? As a society, can we do better?
Oh, look, definitely. We have to do better. I mean, you know, we're a perfect example of it not working, you know. And look, the only people that think that it is working are people that obviously have got their head in the sand, you know. They open your eyes, you know. They talk about people are living on the streets and stuff, and that, and they blame the cost of living crisis and stuff for, you know, first and foremost for that. But, you know, a lot of those people have got drug and alcohol problems, you know, and there's a bunch of people around that say, oh, they're all druggies, that's why they're there, you know. Well, you know, it's not that simple, is it? You know, look, I think back, you know, when I had my head, my concussion, my last concussion, you know, that concussions are compounding, and you know, I had a top job before that, you know, and I would speak in auditoriums to hundreds of people from all over the country, journalists, and you know, I went from that to, in an instant, to being like one step away from living on the street, you know, because my partner at the time turned her back on me, and you know, when I was having massive concussion problems, and I, there was the time when you needed somebody there to support you, you know.
It's difficult, brain injuries, isn't it? I don't know whether we necessarily do that well either.
No, so, you know, it's another form of mental illness, isn't it? You know, so, but it's, we all know, if it was a broken leg, well, you'd get a ton of treatment, but the brain injury, it's not as obvious, but certainly can be way more dramatic. So yeah, hey, look, like I say, we've got to do it differently. I mean, I get annoyed with people blaming the government for everything, but it's got to really, I think it's got to come from the top. Someone like Shane Reddy's got to grab the system and give it a big shake and let a whole lot of monkeys fall out of that tree, because they're dead wood. It's just not working. You know, when we had that family group conference I was talking about before, you know, I called those people out. I said, what do you actually do? You know, what are you doing for my son? You know, and really,
difficult to get an answer.
Yeah. I mean, what are they doing? They're ticking boxes, clipping tickets. They did everything I asked them not to do. They did everything they said they weren't going to do. Yeah, pretty disgraceful. And if you actually took a snapshot of what actually happened when they opened the doors, firstly, he ended up on the street. He could easily have been killed. The police came along, took his medication off him, convincing me that they've got to get his meds right. And the police come along within 2 days and took his meds off him. And they've never, ever followed up and given the meds back. So, I mean, I don't know. There's something wrong with that right there, isn't there? You know, and then the whole fact that, I don't know, look, drunks. I still see a drunk that can walk into a shop absolutely blind drunk and buy liquor. I mean, there's a problem with that. Again, I'm not blaming the liquor store owner for my son's actions, but there's something wrong there, isn't there? Yeah, well, I rang, you know, several houses, you know, drug and alcohol treatment houses, and rang his doctors and stuff and got referrals and got his, you know, what do they call it? Is it a power of attorney or whatever? Mm-hmm. They let me direct it all, and I really sat down. I spent a whole day just ringing around and rattling cages, and he was already on some of those lists that the psych ward had basically put him forward to get on those programs, and they said to me, well, you know, it could be a month, it could be more, it could be 2 months, and I'm going,
we don't have a month.
I don't think I can control this thing that long, you know. Is that the best you can do? I said, we've got a window of opportunity now. I've got him straight. I've got him going to AA meetings. I said, but I don't know how long I can sustain it. I said, surely we should take those wins while they're there. And, you know, nothing happened.
Well, the only thing that did happen is he's picked up again, and opportunity is lost.
Yeah.
It's incredibly sad. I'm sorry that you've had to go through all of that. It is great for our listeners out there to hear the stories of what our actions take towards parents. I really, really appreciate the fact that you've come in and you've been so honest and shared this story. I do hear hope spattered throughout your story, the hope that he can find this, that what you do for him will help him get there.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, when I spoke to him the other day in jail, I sort of regret what I said a wee bit, but it came from the heart. You know, I said to him, how long is this going to go on? I said, when exactly? Do you have any idea when you're going to wake up? Because I sort of would quite like to know. I'm just wondering if it's going to be in my lifetime, because I'd quite like it to be. I sort of quite like us to go back to having a proper relationship again, you know.
Well, that's the pain of a father talking to a son, from what I can hear.
Yeah.
That's difficult. Well, Gordon, I wish you luck. I really appreciate you coming in here and sharing with our listeners your experience, your strength, definitely, and the hope that you have got for him. It's lovely to hear a parent that hasn't turned their back, and I know there are parents out there that are still fighting for their children, and you're not alone. But
I mean, I'd never give up on things, but you know, it's tough. It's more frustrating that you can see an easier way to do it, and
it can't be found. It's not being accessible.
Yeah.
Well, fingers crossed.
Definitely.
We're going to finish with a song that Gordon has chosen, which is a bit of Van Morrison, and it's called The Healing Game. So I think this is quite pertinent.
Definitely.
Here I am again, back on the corner again, back where I belong, where I've always been. Everything the same, it'll never change. I'm back on the corner again, your little healing game. Down those ancient streets, down those ancient roads, where nobody knows, where nobody goes. I'm back on a corner again, where I've always been. Never been away from the healing game. Will the choir boys sing?
Will the choir boys sing?
Will I've always been?
Where I've always been?
Sing a song of soul.
Sing a song of soul.
Baby, don't you know?
Don't you know? Don't you know?
We can let it roll.
We can let it roll.
On a saxophone.
On the saxophone.
Backstreet Jelly Roll.
Backstreet Jelly Roll.
In the healing game.
Sing it out loud.
Sing it in your name. like you're proud.
Sing it like you're proud.
Sing a healing game.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.